Everyone, today I am with the lovely Lisa Clevin, and she's talking from San Francisco. Lisa is an author, illustrator, and a fellow creative. She is the real deal. I adore her work. Elisa, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Mina. I'm honored to be talking with you.
Thank you for making time for me.
Of course. I'm really happy that you asked me to join you and talk about creativity because I admire your work so much.
Thank you. I have read a handful of your books out of the 20, 25 books that you have illustrated and written. Puddle Pail, Sunbread, Hero's Hat. I just absolutely adore your work. You are the Chagall of picture book writing.
So sweet. Thank you.
How are you? How are you doing?
Oh, pretty good overall. I mean, it's been a tough couple of years or year and a half or whatever, but I'm hanging in there and things keep me grounded. My creative work and my friends and my love of nature and family, those are all very important. And so yeah. I can't complain. I can't complain. I got my second vaccine a couple of weeks ago, so I'm feeling less vulnerable, but yeah.
Getting vaccinated and getting back to our lives, feeling
right.
Better. Yeah. How was it during COVID? How did you be creative? I mean, how could you?
I just love to be creative. It's my salvation. Mm-hmm. So I just do it. I try to get up and write stories or draw or make something every day. I can't help myself. And, you know, I try to kind of, I mean, while keeping connected to the world, I also try to just find a refuge from it in my, you know, creative place. I guess I've always done that since I was little. It was just something I went to, like my own little country of imagination.
And which brings you to this, when did you as a kid start creating or doing that kind of actually drawing, creating, making up stories in your mind? When was your first memory? Do you remember?
Oh, I think from the time I could think. I mean, I remember bringing my stuffed animals to life and giving them names and stories, but I think all children do that naturally and then they get trained out of it, you know. But I think we have to fight to keep that childlike imagination alive. And I think I was just happened to be blessed with or cursed with an extra powerful imagination, because from the time I was tiny, I would, you know, every little piece of fruit in the basket at the dinner table had a personality. Actually, I wrote a book called The Apple Doll when I grew up. I would paint faces on walnuts and pretend they were little old people because they were wrinkly and give them hair. And I remember, you know, thinking my slippers were puppy dogs, and I animated everything almost. But now that I think about it, that's not such a bad way to approach the world, because we need more empathy. We need more imagination. And if we treated the world around us as if it were a living being, just like Native American cultures have for thousands of years, we wouldn't be in this predicament where we're killing our own planet. So I fought being told that I was childlike or childish, even worse, all my life. And now I'm like, well, maybe there's something to that kind of imagination. You know, we'd be better off if we used our imaginations. And now empathy is a big, you know, word that's been thrown around. A few years ago, it was edgy. I was being told my stories weren't edgy enough, you know, and now it's like, make it more about empathy. But I don't write about empathy. I try to show empathy and empathetic characters. So anyway, that's a long, long answer, but...
No, that is a perfect answer. And it brings a lot of specific qualities of your work. Your work has heart, the anthropomorphizing of...
Awkward word, I know.
I know, anthropomorphizing.
They you almost just make it so it's impossible to pronounce. So you feel dumb from the start, like if you're doing it. But I would argue that that's a smart way of looking at the world. Okay.
Absolutely. I just think that's how we relate. You touched a
It
nerve here. I think doing that anthropomorphization of
is.
an apple or a chair or
Right.
a fireplace, the way we're used to seeing on a more mass media version of it in Disney
Right. Well,
or
Disney can do it. And maybe that's because Disney's a big commercial enterprise, so, or they have permission, but.
We have permission to do whatever we want.
Right, we do.
So don't listen to anyone. Do your
I
thing.
won't. I'll try to filter all those weird voices out. But we live in a very capitalistic
Exactly.
consumer society, so, and we start internalizing that message and thinking good if money sell, if money is involved and if it sells good.
But you touched on on that nerve that, first of all, you fought growing up, you refused becoming an adult, and kudos to us and all of us who have tried to keep a little bit of that.
Right.
Let them call us childish, that's fine. We're actually childlike and we know what we're doing. You know what you're doing because I am in awe and
Oh,
admiration of your
you're
work.
too kind.
You know, it just really makes me think about how I was always thinking picture books are a work of art. They're not just children's literature.
No, of course
And
not. They're one of the most challenging works of art.
absolutely. And
Not
nobody
kinds
gives
of
us that
art.
kind of respect. It's
I think the children's book community does really exalt children's books, and it's sort of like there's a new golden age with these fabulous, incredible geniuses making children's books. But
Yes.
I mean, much more sophisticated than what I do. But Kadir Nelson, or just like amazing, brilliant luminaries are in children's books, so they get that kind of respect. But I think we do have a lot of ambivalence about it as a culture.
The fact that you stayed and you created and you are what you are is so it's so amazing. And it brings me to the context you grew up in. What kind of a family environment was that for your art and creativity?
Well, I was the youngest of four kids, so I was like in this big tribe. I had a, very happy early childhood. They didn't hover in those days. I don't even remember actually being read to as a child. As soon as I could read, I would read to myself. I don't remember sitting on a lap and looking at a picture book, but I remember just gobbling up any kind of picture books that were given to me or that I got at the library. And then I just My mother was an artist, which was a huge influence, but she was a printmaker and etcher, and she did these very graphic, bold, like completely opposite from my style, very kind of heavy subject. She did a lot of social justice work before there was a word for woke. She was woke. She was doing things about civil rights and police brutality, but these big kind of scary looking almost etchings and prints. She would find old things at the junkyard and make them into her and recycle them, reuse them, and make her work out of that. And I mean, so that was exciting, but it wasn't really, I didn't really feel like I could do anything like that. I just made my own kind. And then my grandmother was a sculptor and she made characters out of clay. So they were definitely influences I was surrounded by, and she lived with us for long periods of time. So, and she was a Holocaust survivor. Well, her family was, she escaped Ukraine before the Nazis, but her whole family was wiped out. She and her sister got out, but the rest of her family died. But then she was always making them in her art, which was really powerful to see her resurrect these lost worlds in her sculptures. And so that was great. And I always got art supplies as presents. Like I would just want a Barbie so badly. I just lusted after Barbies. And, I would just look at them and, like, why can't I have the Barbie dream house? But my mom would give me clay and oil pastels and paper and glue. And she would say, make your own dolls. So I did. Yeah. And then I made a big dollhouse, which was my training for becoming a picture book creator, because I was making characters and giving them names and stories and personalities and making settings for them. So when people ask, how did you learn to make picture books? It's like, well, I've just been doing this for as long as I can remember. It just my dollhouse worlds got put between my picture book covers, and that's where they have kind of a naive, childlike look with lots of color, because that's just what I've always liked.
What a fabulous story. Oh my God.
Thank you.
Your mom, your grandma, and the way she was a Holocaust survivor, it's just, oh gosh.
And she had a lot of pain in her, but she never really talked about it. And I think she was humane. She didn't want to freak out a little child or her other grandchildren. But also, I just think so much of her grief got channeled into her beautiful work, which was very, it was actually more cheerful than a lot of my mom's. She would like smiling children out of clay. And some of them had a lot of sorrow, but mostly they were very tender. I think that's the word I would say was tender.
It makes me think about something that is happening right now in the art world, and I am not very happy about it.
What is that?
The fact that you said your grandma was humane, she communicated through her sculptures, she communicated through her life, she communicated through the love she gave you guys. And rather than going on the top of the hill and screaming at the top of your lungs. But then
Right.
on the other hand, I'm thinking that people who are going on the top of the hill and screaming at the top of the lungs, they're getting some results
Right,
better
I
than,
know. But you
you
know
know?
what? I
Yeah.
think they're louder, but they're not more. You know, the louder ones, and sometimes they can affect great change. You don't want, I mean, Martin Luther King did it by being loud and gentle. You know, you don't want to
Yes.
be too nice in these situations, but most people are. I think a lot of people really are quiet and gentle,
Yes.
and they endure horror. But it, you know, but they just kind
Yes.
of channel it in these quiet, gentle ways. And a lot of the time they just go, they're silent, you know, and sometimes
Yes.
they're not recognized, you know, they're not calling attention to themselves, but
Right.
they're
Right.
still doing their best to make the world a better
They
place.
are. They are. We can't all be screamers. We're not born like that. Some of us are
No.
and some of us are not. And
Right.
people express themselves the way they know best. But I think the
Right.
generations are also changing. And there's a more movement in my mind towards being literal.
Right.
I don't know if I'm right or not, but I feel it. What is a typical day of creating for you these days?
I get up and I start doodling and I read and then I look at social media. I look at Facebook because I actually, for all the horrible things on Facebook, and as much as I hate Facebook and everything about it, I see beautiful things on it too that make me happy. So I go on it and then I think, oh, well, this person who, like my friend Jema, who celebrates children's books and everything about them, always has beautiful pictures posted on her site, Jema Radican. And I see other artists' work or nature pictures or things I feel so strongly about. And then I get infuriated when I read political things and how stupid and messed up the world is. And then I go off Facebook and I draw and I look at the story draft I wrote the last day before that I sent myself to see what was good or bad about it. And then I check email and I sometimes do commissions. I've been doing some private commissions for people, like making art for weddings or a child, somebody whose child died recently, a grown up, well, like a 25, 30-year-old child. And I made a special piece for somebody who wanted to give them a gift. So that's very meaningful, you know, besides the children's book world. I just do things like that. And then I work on my stories and I wait to hear back from editors. You know, it's just a lot of waiting. I think one important thing is to be very patient and also to always be busy, because if you are always checking to see if somebody got back to you that said they were going to get back to you 3 weeks ago, you can drive yourself crazy, you know. So that's how I cope. But it's not easy. And by nature, artists or creators are sensitive, but it's a very big pair. The world is pretty brutal, including the world of publishing, and you have to have a thick skin. I love this quote by Kurt Vonnegut, something like, I can do very little about like the world, about fixing the world around me, but I can reduce to order this piece of paper, this square of canvas, and this block of stone. Like I can make it my own little world. I can do very little about the chaos around me. That's what he said, the chaos around me. But I can reduce to perfect order this square of canvas, this piece of paper, this block of stone. So that's kind of my mantra. Like when I'm feeling frustrated, like, okay, they have their lives. They're probably very busy. Go make your picture. You have perfect control over your picture or your story at this point.
About the kind of formal education you got and the informal education and other jobs and careers you might have had.
I went to Berkeley. I started when I was pretty young, 17. I left LA and started Berkeley, and I was overwhelmed and didn't like it very much, but I found my way and connected with the people I needed to learn from and ended up really loving it. And I had the privilege of being taught, you know, Shakespeare or American literature or world literature by some of the finest minds ever. So that really helped in terms of, you know, writing, you know, just learning about the power of words and how to use it carefully. That was incredibly creative, incredibly like, not, well, it was creative, but also just a good education. And then I always did art on my own. In my dorm room, I would make like Ukrainian eggs and little bread sculptures. And I just always did it because that's how I centered myself. And that was my therapy, you know, it still is. I don't really ever see a therapist. Maybe I should, because I have my issues, but but I end up like painting. I used to paint Ukrainian eggs, like dye them like they're done with batik. And I would do that over and over, starting the time my mom died when I was had just turned 14, which is painful anyway. 14 is a horrible age, but on top of that, my mom died and my father the same, like 6 months later, married a pretty horrible stepmother who moved in with two kids. And I felt like she just resented my existence. So maybe that's why I started finding these little spaces. And they were very small, because I felt like I had to like make myself as small as possible. But within that small space, I would create as much detail and these passionate little worlds that kind of screamed out like complexity, right?
Oh my gosh.
So that's what I did to cope, and that kept me alive, and it still does. But anyway, back to formal training. So I just...
Hey, can I say something? When you talk, I enter a world and it's beautiful and it's sad and it's just gorgeous, and you're such a wonderful storyteller.
Oh, thank you, Mina.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I was named after a character in a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, Elisa from the tale The Wild Swans. I ended up being rescued by a Danish farm family. My stepmother kicked me out, and I ended up like going as an exchange student to Denmark. So I think there's something just kind of like fated about that, kind of the story of my life. I really lucked out in publishing early on, because I found that wonderful person who nurtured me and who understood the kind of stories I was writing, who cared about children being satisfied, not feeling like they were being educated to be the most, whatever the trend was that day, edgy and now woke or whatever, empathetic, you know, it's all just words. And she really did nurture me, and I was so lucky. She was a brilliant editor. She had luminaries like Paul Zelinsky, Ashley Wolfe, Lloyd Alexander on her list. And then, you know, then not enough sales. I don't know. That's capitalism. But so I was very lucky for a long time to have that one person. And now, you know, I'm hoping to find one again. So right now I'm waiting and waiting and waiting, because somebody said they loved something I did. Every week I get a little dose of love, and then I wait some more. So who knows? Right.
But and so you went to Berkeley. You didn't get too shabby of an education.
No, I got a great education, and I was a really good student. I got like I was Phi Beta Kappa. I always wanted to write good papers. I was a perfectionist. I was just doing this very naive art the whole time, and then I just tried to stumble my way into publishing, and I got some rejections. Mm-hmm. Actually, I got the first nibble I got on a book was based on the story, but the editor did not like my artwork. She said it was, quote, I'll always remember this, it's too California. So what do you mean? Big editor in New York City, you know? What do you mean it's too California? And she said, it looks kind of psychedelic. Can you just pare it? Can you focus it and pare it down? And so I did and did and did. And then she took the story. And but when I go back and when I do school visits, sometimes, well, I show the kids my first one. And I said, and I don't say anything. I just say, which do you like better? And they all say the first one before it was like pared down, before it was streamlined and mainstreamed. They like the energy and the wildness of the first one. But no, you have to listen to these people too. It's a it's a big compromise, but not to lose your passion and your original vision, because I know I'm very malleable and very impressionable. And somebody says, this is wild, or this doesn't make sense, or this is too sloppy, then I internalize that. So even though I sound tough and like I'm determined to be true to myself, I'm not. No, I'm just a big wimp. I take these things very personally, and then I start being self-destructive. So
we all go through so much rejection. Sometimes it's just, it just becomes funny how I'm like, oh, and I'm back up again, and I'm back up again.
Right, exactly. You have to get back up again. And then you realize it's just so subjective. And like you were saying at the beginning, some people like vanilla, some people like chocolate.
So how all of these rejections and, you know, hardships with the fact that your mom passed away at you were such an early age and not good family situation, how does all that help or hinder your creative life? Do you think it did make it made you more creative and made you want to express more or less?
That's such a good question. I often wonder how I would be if my mother hadn't died, because she was such a strong artist and role model. But we also kind of butted heads. I remember at a very early age telling me that a picture I'd made was sentimental. Like, I'm 5 years old. I want pretty pictures with flowers. And, you know, that was such a weird comment to make to a very tiny child. But she was ruthless. Like, I'm not, you know, it's sentimental. She never pulled any punches, but for better or for worse. I don't know. I think I have a lot of layers of pain and grieving in me. And maybe that's made me more sensitive. I've heard about people, like I'm an animal lover, and I've read about people who love animals who had tough childhoods or even abusive childhoods. And they go either way. They can either become they can become animal abusers themselves, or they can be like super empathetic. And so I think in some ways it may be a hyper empath, because I feel things deeply and I feel when an animal or a person is suffering. I do. I'm not trying to boast. Like, I'm so empathetic. Give me a book contract. But I am. I'm an empath. And I can't help myself. But maybe that's made me a better artist. I don't know. I hope so.
It's made you a fantastic artist.
Sometimes when I feel overwhelmed by the incredible, just the desperation of the world around me, from stray abused animals to fascists taking over our own country to Syrian children starving and freezing in winter, I feel like I can't take it all on, and no human can. And we're living in an age where I don't think people are meant to know everything that's happening every moment in the world, but we are. And that is our burden. That is our blessing and our curse right now, that we know every bit of suffering. And as empathetic people, you can't function if you're going to take it all in. So one little bit of therapy I do for myself, luckily, I'm in a position where I can. I mean, I'm not rich by any means. I do need a book contract, but or I need to teach art. I have to make a living. My husband had a serious stroke last year, and you know, it's not. It's I'm not sorry. Playing around. I'm not playing around here, you know. But on the other hand, I can afford $50 or $75 or $25. So I'll give like $70 to the Syrian children, and then I won't feel like I have to look at the. I mean, I can't. I could look at them all day and just cry all day. Or $50 to the Humane Society for 6 months, you know. And then I feel like I've done my duty, and then I've let myself off the hook, and maybe that's a cop out. I should be out there doing it all day long, but I can't, because I'm not made that way. And I would suffer myself. I have to I also have to be selfish. Artists are selfish. There was a book, a movie I loved that came out maybe 20 years ago called Fly Away Home, about a little girl who rescued a goose that had been abandoned by its mother, and she was thinking about her own mother who had died, and her mother was an artist. I remember a line from it, which was, "Artists are selfish." I mean, it's true. We pay attention. We fret. I spend a lot of energy that could be spent in a better, more humane way, fretting about whether my editor is going to get back to me that day. And I look at my daughter, who works with impoverished children in Oakland. She's a third grade teacher. It's her fifth year of teaching. And there's just an altruism among that kind of person. They're teachers. They give all day long. And artists don't. We give to ourselves so that we can give ultimately to the world. But I think, I mean, I'm not altruistic in that same way. I think I'm humane and empathetic, but there are certain people who are total helpers and saviors. And art saves in a different way. But I think in order to be the best artist, you also have to take very good care of yourself, and you have to know your own limitations. And if I worked in an animal shelter, I'd probably go nuts and die of depression, because I would see all that suffering all day long. And as a hypersensitive person, I can't handle it. You know, I just can't.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is something about self-preservation. I don't want to call it selfishness because I know a lot of artists that do this because they're just trying to be human beings, but
Right. No, that's true. That's a
we're
good
not,
difference.
we're not like on the floor of Wall Street trying to make money and money
Right.
and money
Exactly.
and
That's
money and money.
selfish. That's
I think
selfish.
that's like you. I'm in awe of people who are able to be involved with that kind of charity work and put of themselves out there. I used to go to a meditation that our teacher used to say, imagine you're in a bubble and kind of like you need to put that around you before you enter the meditation because you want to feel safe and you don't want to let things get to you. So in a
Right.
way, she was trying to make us I mean, it's hard to you've touched on so many important things that I just the fact that we're connected in a matter of milliseconds to the entire world, and
Right.
we can, if we let ourselves, see all the pain and suffering that's going around the world. I don't want to stop what's going on in India right now with COVID-19.
India, I know, like 50,000 people dying a day, or what's going on in Israel and Palestine.
We care because I know you and I have lost a few hours of sleep over it this
Right.
week. I know this is how we are, but what can you do aside from writing a check here or there?
Right. And sometimes I volunteer. I do get out there
Yeah,
sometimes,
I
but
mean, but you can't get on the plane and go to
no,
India. You can't ask that from yourself and beat yourself up for not being able to
no,
do
you can't. You just do your best, really,
Yeah.
you know, and try not to be self-destructive or hurt anybody else along the way. If you can do that, that's pretty good. Give
Yeah.
yourself points, you know, because like you're saying, a lot of people don't do that. People on Wall Street, you know, just
I mean, yeah.
money crazed people, they just don't think about it.
What advice do you have for people who want to write, become published, or people who want to live a creative life?
Well, I think setting aside time is very important, because you have to. That's how you will plant your garden, is if you show up and you're in your creative space. And even if you don't feel inspired, making yourself do something, write a few sentences. If you're an artist, draw something, fill a page with horrible drawings and then throw them out. But at least you will have done it. It's like exercising. And then the more you do it, the less painful it will become. And before you know it, you're enjoying it. And before you know it, maybe you've written something that you're proud of, or illustrated something that will get other people happy. You just have to start somewhere. Read a lot, nurture your own mind, find books that you love. I used to take, and I still do, take home stacks of books from the library and just look at them and enjoy them and don't even try, just absorb them. And they might inspire you on some deep level. Look at the things that made you happy as a child. What books did you love? Why did they touch you? I tell people to go back to the books they loved as a child. Sometimes I go back to the ones I loved, and I have this kind of bittersweet feeling like, would this 2,000-word picture book be published now? It might not be because it's not 500 words, but I think that's an arbitrary construction. I think children will listen to anything if it's a good story. They'll listen to any word count if they're absorbed by it. If you have that little bit of spark of creativity, just explore it and be good to it. And if it doesn't end up being published, that's not your fault. You know, it's an arbitrary world. Maybe you'll get lucky, or maybe your talent is so brilliant that nobody can, that it's rejection proof. That's like one in a gazillion. But you know, but even if it isn't, it
Well, I
doesn't mean
mean,
it's not
we
good.
have them everywhere. I mean, I named him at the beginning. I mean, look at Van Gogh. I mean, how many
Right.
works did he actually sell when he was
None. His brother bought his only work.
exactly?
Emily Dickinson gave up and wrote her little beautiful poems, her sonnets, and everything in an
Absolutely.
attic for how many years, you know?
It's important to create. It's important to not be overly critical and editorial to yourself. And it's funny how I ask this from everyone, all the creatives that I talk to, and all of you say, put time aside for creating because you have to.
And also try not, you can be self-critical, but try not to be your own most savage critic, because there's a million people waiting at the door who are
Oh,
going to do that. They're
yeah.
all happy, you know, because you know why? Because it's so much easier to take something down, to critique something, than to create something.
Absolutely.
Because the
Absolutely.
creator is making something out of nothing, and the critic is making something out of something. So 99% of the work is done for them. They have to put their own little stamp on it. Fine. Okay, that's your job. But if you're a creator, just remember you're doing the harder part and you have to do most of the work. And it's easy to tear it down, but it's not so easy to create it. So be good to yourself.
So you have won many, many awards. You
No, I
have many,
haven't.
many
Not that
books. Yes,
much.
you have. Yes, you have. Don't be modest. We know you. It's all on your
Well, you
it's
don't
all
put
on
all the
your,
bad reviews you've gotten on
you
your
know,
website,
websites and okay,
so
whatever. If somebody didn't
this
like
book
it, they didn't like it.
sucked.
But and you've given a TED talk, and you know you've been shortlisted, longlisted, backlisted, frontlist, everything.
I like being
You
backlisted. That means the books are still in print,
blacklisted.
despite
You're
all
even
odds. Yeah,
blacklisted.
maybe not blacklisted.
Yeah, maybe not yet. You are a creative soul that everybody looks up to, and hundreds and thousands of people have read your book. At this point, Elisa, what is something that you would like to improve in your creativity?
I actually do see the temptation of digital art. I see so many beautiful effects done. So I'd like to become a little more technically adroit. I'm trying to teach myself Photoshop on and off and just like use it as a tool. It's kind of like fire. It's very powerful. It can take over or it can be used to improve something. So I just like to have that as a tool in my toolbox. But also just to keep trying to write thought-provoking, interesting, I hope beautiful books for children that make them think. I hope to find a place in this world where I can do that without constant anxiety, which I've kind of been in lately. And, you know, I just want to keep improving as long as I live. I want to keep doing this. I have a, like you said, I have a lot of stories in
Oh
me.
my gosh. And you will, because look at all these gorgeous books
Oh, well, thank
that are
you.
there out there, and you will make many, many more, of
Thank
course.
you, Nina.
We
I love
cannot wait
hearing
to
that
see
from
them.
you. That's so sweet. And
Well,
back
it's
at ya.
just true. I'm just not, you know, I'm not complimenting you. I'm not nice.
Okay, thank you. No,
I'm
okay.
a very vicious person, but I happen
Yeah.
to like you.
Thank you. Okay. Even more special. Okay.
I can't believe somebody that's an expert wants to improve their technical.
Oh, I do. I do. Believe
But
me.
that's just a good example for everyone that's listening at how people who are successful are always trying to grow themselves and learn new things. I cannot thank you enough, but before I'll let you go. last thoughts that you want to give us about maybe marketing and publicity, social media, the
Yeah, I'm a Stone Age person. I started publishing in the late 80s, and I didn't realize how lucky I was. Like, just write the book and the publicity department will market it, Now
Wow.
it the onus is on the creator to publicize. And I don't blame people for wanting to be on Instagram and Facebook and whatever else. Twitter, I'm not on Twitter, but I'm on Instagram and Facebook, and you have to promote yourself. That's just the reality. But it's a very power, it's like fire, again, that fire analogy, can be used for good or ill, as we know. We know that. I mean, look at the bad people on social media who undermine democracy throughout the world. You just have to be very careful. And the same with social media. I feel sorry for young people because everything is there, and once you've said something, you can't, it stays there forever. And it's almost like it's too powerful a tool to be used by vulnerable, young, growing people. But you have to now. I mean, again, for like young authors and illustrators, you have to use it, but just be prudent about it. Maybe don't do something you'll regret. It can't hurt. So I try to use it sparingly, but maybe because I have the luxury of using it sparingly. Like I said, I love my Facebook and I go on to see the beautiful things, political, interesting things. Try to do it in the morning and then not look at it all day because it's a big distraction. But once in a while it's good to be distracted and to know what's out there. So I just think in moderation, it's a good idea.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mina, for your wonderful, insightful questions.